Yeah, just continuing with Ryan Robinson on 20th July 73. So besides, it was Gardner and...
Well, Pawsey, who was leader of the training group, had come through this same school. Ron Bracewell, Frank Gardner. Perhaps they were the only one, but one had an impression that there were more.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot of Australian physicists and radio physicists had come through this school.
And then you did.
Piddington had to, Jack Piddington. Mm-hmm. And I did as well.
And what was your dissertation on?
It was an investigation of the E region, trying to get, from accurate group delay measurements, getting the electron distribution.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a successful project. By the time it was finished, people were flying Era B rockets through the atmosphere and measuring the electron density directly.
Excuse me, Brian. Okay.
But I kept in fairly close contact with radio astronomy because I was I had reasonable contact with the I was in the same room basically with all the graduate students in radio astronomy, so I knew what was.
They were all,
it was going on.
The groups were that close together, really.
Yes.
Radcliffe and Rouse groups.
Yes, all the graduate students were in one big loft, big attic, that had all the graduate students in it, all mixed in together. And I used to go to their colloquia and meetings and things. So. You know, when I went back to Cambridge to do a colloquium last month, Ra welcomed me as one of his old boys.
Didn't mention that you turned down all his visas, right?
But so I established very close personal relationships with all the radio astronomers in Cambridge and kept in touch with what they were, they were doing. And when I graduated from Cambridge, I
which was when?
That would have been end of 57. I wanted to go back into radio astronomy. And I came to Leiden, where they had a project to, in connection with the physics lab in Leiden and with Philips Research Labs, to develop a 21 centimeter maser. The three-level solid-state maser had only had recently been invented by Bloombergen, and they were keen to have a 21 centimeter maser on the Bloomberg telescope.
And this was still before it had been Townsend Mary put it on the NRL dish. That was 58, I think.
Yes, this was.
I don't remember.
I came to Barton at the beginning of 58, so we knew other people were trying.
Yeah. But were there others besides NRL that were trying also?
I think the Lincoln Lab group were building masers, not specifically with a radio astronomy application. But the NRL was the only place for the radio astronomy interest. Anyway, we joined in that competition. But we were building cavity masers, and they were notoriously short on bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time that we thought, well, cavity masers aren't going to make it, we'll have to go for a traveling wave maser. And we had problems getting materials of Lindy Bulls, Ruby Bulls, and things like that from Lindy Corporation, hard to get here at the time. But while we were just building our first traveling wave maser, papers started to appear in the literature about parametric amplifiers. During 58, the first rectal diodes were produced, and people were starting to talk about parametric amplifiers. And I got heavily stuck into that, in the Schumann on the theoretical side. And we decided to build a parametric and compare its performance with the maser. And actually, in the corridor outside here, there's a photograph on the wall of our very first parametric.
I see.
Which happened to be at 2 gigahertz. The choice of 2 gigahertz was that we used for the apparent the same pump that we'd been using for pumping our maser, which happened to be at 4 gigahertz.
I see.
Decided that the easiest thing to try to start with was a degenerate apparent. So I'll show you as we go out.
Yeah.
It's a background photograph to one of the displays outside, but it's there, large as life on the bench.
Was that one of the, or was that the first parent that was used, or was it used ever on the dish?
No, well, that was a 2 gigahertz one, and there was no interest in 2 gigahertz. But we went on then to build 21 centimeter power amps. Partly from one of the live wires around the stiffing at the time was Charles Seeger, who you mm-hmm. were interviewed.
No, I haven't, but it's on my list.
He'd be well worth interviewing. You know, again, I remember in one discussion with Charles, we saw that masers were hard to build at 1.4 gigahertz, but you could do much better at 10 gigahertz.
Mm-hmm. A maser over a parent?
Yes, in terms of the bandwidth you got and the ease of the overall performance just was very much better. The filling factors you could get in cavities and mm-hmm. the crystals we could grow. I was very interested in up converters, and Charles made the suggestion, well, why don't you build a 10 gigahertz maser and a 1.4 to 10 gigahertz up converter? So this seemed a tremendous thing to do. But the project ended up that we built an up converter to a regenerative parent.
And why did they?
And that was built because of the very wide bandwidth of the up converter and the ease of tuning it. It was built for aiming for extragalactic 21 centimeter work. And two of those were built, one for the Dwimlo dish and one for one for the Park dish.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the Park's one back too. So at the second half of the end of 1961, the Park's telescope was completed. I went back to Australia.
Oh, so you were here 3 years actually in Holland.
Yes, I arrived at being here 58 and left mm-hmm. in 61 to when the Park's telescope was completed.
Well, before we get into Australia, can I ask you, who was, you say parents, or the diodes came in around 58 or so, who was the first to use them in radio astronomy, really?
First to use them in radio astronomy, that's so tricky. I have to think back on that one now.
Okay, well, we can let it pass for now.
The regenerative parent was essentially a very unstable device. And one of the big contributions we made here was in showing how to stabilize it,
mm-hmm.
get stable gain out of it. But who got the first one on a dish?
I think it must be somewhat later than 58, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, nobody had one on a dish in 58, did they?
Yeah.
Not a chance. But I'm sure there were others on dishes before I got the one going that time. Probably one of the very first ones was a 408 megahertz parent, which I built for Charles Seeger. It was put on the Dwimlo dish at the beginning of the attempts here to measure polarization. And that would have been probably 1960.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been one of the one of the very early ones.
Okay.
Well,
not so. Don't worry about it anymore.
It's certainly something which I could check back on. But there isn't an obvious, group. Not like the NRL Mesa, which was they were clearly ahead of everyone else.
The other question I wanted to ask was something that is part of Edge and Mulcahy's thesis, so to speak, that the interaction between the science and the technology, it's rather striking from what you've been talking, that sort of something becomes available and you use it in radio astronomy, and that then influences the course of radio astronomy. You go to higher frequencies or you do polarization or this or that. Do you see it this way, that sort of how radio astronomy has developed? In other words, not so much we have a project, we have a scientific aim now, what can we build to do that, but rather sort of a little bit backwards.
I don't know whether it's backwards,
right.
But I think it's very much the case that in a lot of radio astronomy, even up to the present day, people have found astrophysical projects that they can use their existing, they can use equipment that they happen to have. In the very early days of radio astronomy, people had radar antennas and radar receivers left over from the war, and pressed these into service. I think the Dutch group has been more oriented than anyone to having an astrophysical interest coming first and building equipment to suit. But I'd say that the course of radio astronomy has been basically dominated by the inventions of different types of telescopes and technological improvements in receiving systems. But there would be no millimeter wave radio astronomy unless Burris had built his diodes.
Mm-hmm.
But having built his diodes, people like Penzias and Wilson became interested in seeing what could be done there. And you'll probably talk to Arnaud Penzias about
that. I haven't yet, but
about why he worked for CEO. Well, that's an interesting story. He didn't intend to work for carbon monoxide.
He's looking for another amount here?
Well, you can talk to Arnaud about it exactly. It's recorded fairly well in...
Well, that's right, he has a chapter in a book. Well, I have a copy of that.
Physics Today, March 1973. There's an article by Phil Solomon.
Oh, yes. Yes, I have read that.
And that tells the story.
I don't remember it exactly either, but I remember now in the introduction part of that there was
I've got a copy of it just over the corridor. But go back and read it somewhere in the middle of Phil Solomon's article. Physics Today, March.
Yeah, I know the article. I have tore it out also.
So that's that can go with it. But I think this is a general rule in science.
In science as a whole, you think? Yeah.
Well, the big advances in science are always associated with improvements in instrumentation. And Westerbork's a good example of a dramatic change in how people think about radio astronomy. Westerbork is massive.
W-M-51.
I think right through radio astronomy, this touched an even more mark than in other branches of science. An extra factor of 10 in sensitivity or an extra factor of 10 in resolution has opened up all sorts of projects that one wouldn't have anticipated. One didn't dream that would be there. But people, for technological reasons, were going after the extra resolution just to see what they could find. So it was technological development per se.
Okay. Well, back to you personally. You went to Australia in 60. One, did you say?
61.
And you carried this parent up with you?
Yes.
And the Park Station was just, was it not yet going quite, was it?
It was commissioned at the end of 61 and got going during 62.
Yeah, so you were not involved at all in the whole business of the Park Station? beforehand.
But you mean the sort of fighting that led to
and the actual building of
natural building.
But once again, Frank,
in the time here, I mean, building the sleepers, it was Park Fish that I had in mind, with the stiffening. But the aim was that when the Park Fish came along.
Did it get on the dish?
So I spent 62 and 63, and probably sometime after that, using the parent that I built here for extragalactic 21 centimeter work on southern spirals. And that I intended to spend 10 years doing that. But at the end of 63, it's been that October 63, Wino et al. Discovered the 18 centimeter OH lines, the 1665 and 1667 lines. And it turned out that part of my part of this parent that I built involved a multiplier chain to 1600 megahertz. I had I converted from 1.4 gigahertz to 2.4, and I actually had a degenerate parent of 2.4, so I was pumping that at 4.8. And the 4.8 gigahertz pump was tripled up from a 16. From a multiplier chain, a high power multiplier chain, that ended up at 1.6 gigahertz. So we had a stable LO system run off a frequency of a synthesizer. Well, may not quite appropriate, we're running off in those days, probably even the early synthesizers. So basically, with the addition of a mixer, we had a good LH receiver. And within a month of the winery discovery of weak OH absorption in Cassiopeia, we'd seen OH absorption in the galactic center. And there's some funny history there, because...
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, I couldn't remember what it was, but there is a story there.
Well, there's a funny story there, because we'd rushed this receiver up, Frank Gardner and myself. He'd built the mixer, or converted a 21 centimeter mixer properly, and I provided the LO system, not to feed together.
Yeah.
And this was all done in about 5 days. We got it on the telescope. And the
The impetus of the Nature article, yes.
Well,
or did you have prior notes?
We had private communication from either Alan, probably from Alan Barrett. We would have preprint from probably from Alan. And so this was before the publication. So I think it took us about. I had an extragalactic 21 centimeter period on the telescope, and I decided to use the time for OH, rather than the 21 centimeter work. And in 5 days we had a receiver going, but we didn't know much about the receiver. And when we looked at Sagittarius A, we had a horrible baseline slope. We had a fairly narrow band. We only explored for reasons which, in terms of available oscillators and things, we can only explore a few hundred kilohertz. We had a horrible baseline slope on Sagittarius A, but on the middle of that baseline slope there was quite clear absorption and dip. We were very puzzled that when we went to Orion A, the baseline slope disappeared. But of course Orion A is a much stronger source. No, those, I think, were the only two sources we looked at. Maybe have been some others, but this awful baseline slope only appeared on Sagittarius A. So we rushed back to Sydney to send a letter to Nature, and there was a great discussion whether we should publish our profile or not. And the consensus opinion was that radio physics thought too highly of its technical expertise to publish a very lousy book with such a lousy first line slope on it. And we were in a hurry to get the better off dimension, so that we were not too far behind the initial discovery. We saw the distortion about a month after one wrote it out. And so we were indoctrinated as saying the distortion had been seen at zero velocity and not seen very much more.
You didn't actually mention the slope and so forth in the letter?
I think we said baseline slope had been subtracted.
Yeah,
we didn't publish any.
You gave any numbers or you didn't certainly.
We just gave the optical depth of the on this slope there was a little notch. We extrapolated across the notch and we had an optical depth for it. It was obviously the right order of magnitude of absorption. And it wasn't until then we went back to make this, to really work on this receiver and try to get rid of the baseline slope and rebuilt the thing and went back to look at Sagittarius A a few months later. And by that time we were exploring a much bigger, a much wider band. We pushed the backing bandwidth up quite a bit. And of course we found that what we were sitting on was not a deep absorption. It was not a bad baseline, but was an enormously deep absorption.
And wide.
An optical depth of one. Extremely wide, and something that one would never have. We were influenced, of course, we knew what the 21 centimeter absorption profile of the galactic center looked like, and we were looking for something that matched it.
And also the OH absorption in CAS.
Had matched the 21 centimeter absorption very, very closely.
Right.
Extremely good agreement on all the components. And we were not prepared for an absorption profile that was something like two orders of magnitude stronger than we anticipated, and also so very broad.
So I presume there was a second letter to Nature a few weeks ago.
There was a second publication. Even there, for technical reasons, we could only cover a certain band. And we covered a band from about minus 50 kilometers a second to about plus 100.
Hmm.
And there was a nice bit of absorption there. We still had. And we. It wasn't until the next time we were on that we went to more negative velocities and found that there was a negative velocity dip.
Mm-hmm.
And it had an even more negative velocity.
Now the OH emission, you were involved in that right at the beginning, were you?
Well, there's another story there.
Well, maybe there's more than I know, okay.
If you look in Nature 1965, you'll see a paper by McGee, Robinson, Bolton, and Gardner.
Yeah.
Tell a bit of the story here. It's a bit like, remember I was saying Sagittarius A and Orion, and Sagittarius A shows this baseline slope of Orion. But we then got interested in the galactic center. It's a place where there was a lot of OH. And Dick McGee and I started off to do a big survey of the galactic center. Found a lot of absorption over a big range.
Right.
It was quite a big project. Most of the survey was done at 1667 megahertz, but we'd done a selection of the points in the field. And it's a very big area we had to cover. We'd done selected points, mainly the strongest sources, on the other three electrons. Oh, this is something I should have mentioned. We got distracted probably from some of the other activities, such as finding the negative velocity absorption Sagittarius A, because we set out to try to find the other two OH lines, the two satellite lines, 1712 and 1720.
Which hadn't been detected at that point?
No, and we set out and did detect those, and that sidetracked us for a while.
So you were the first to find them?
We were the first to find those. That was published in Fitzgerald Letters, I think.
I don't think I've ever seen that paper.
No, that John Bolton decided that should go to Fitzgerald Letters because it was sort of more basic physics
of hyperfine states and all.
But it got a bit lost there. A lot of astronomers didn't see Fitzgerald Letters.
Yeah.
I missed that paper.
That's 64,
63? 64.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the course of looking at all these sources in the Galactic Centre region and the four OH lines, most of us, the complete survey, the fully sampled survey was in 1667. We had a 1665 profile on Sagittarius B2.
Mm-hmm.
Now because we were studying this wide absorption, we were using wide filters, 33 kilohertz filters, not 37 kilohertz filters. 37, no mistake. And on Sagittarius B2, there was a channel around about plus 60 kilometers a second, which there's a big deep absorption, but a channel about plus 60 had no absorption in it. It was only about one channel. I think there's just one channel. And if you pop the profile out, you haven't got a video recorder. So you've got this deep absorption, zero here.
Right.
And this one channel came up,
went back up to zero.
And it puzzled us a while, but in multi-channel receivers, channels do die occasionally, and we thought, well, it was just odd that channel happened to die, and we didn't see that it was, that on the previous source we looked at, 10 minutes before, on the source we looked at 10 minutes afterwards, that channel was okay.
Nor did you follow it up by shifting the yellow or things like that, I guess.
No, we wouldn't, because we were trying to survey on that area.
Yeah.
And just one.
You just took it as an anomaly. I mean, now you can look back and say, oh, gee, we've obviously shifted the yellow, but
one anomalous result. Now, we didn't have any narrow band filters of this. Nothing narrower than 33 kilohertz. But in the course of 1965, we built up some 10 kilohertz filters. And I was doing detailed studies on the relative absorption on four OH lines in terms of thermal population distributions. Because the 1720 lines were twice as strong as the 1612 lines in absorption. And this odd, dead channel kept plaguing us.
And you remember it from before?
Then we got a letter, then we got a preprint of the Berkeley results. And you must have on tape the Berkeley, Harvard,
right.
History.
Talked to several people about that, right?
Ellen Glinderman and
Mandeter and Sam Goldstein was there also.
Yeah. Well, that was a very, very funny story. But at the moment we got a preprint of the Berkeley paper on Mysterium, which reported W3 and W49.
I think that's W3
and
W49. The very first paper, yeah.
The moment we got that, we tore back to Parkes and put our recently built narrowband filters on Sagittarius B2. And as expected, this thing.
So you did remember it from before, yeah?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was, within a week we had the system. We were back on the telescope and with the narrowband filters, that thing, instead of being a channel that went to zero, went into emission. But we were limited there by the absence of narrowband filters. That's where we were stymied.
Yeah.
Even if we'd shifted the LO, and we probably had observed it at other periods.
You would have interpreted it as a lack of absorption.
Because it was just a curious lack of absorption on frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that it went so quick. So the fact that it with the wide filter, it didn't go into emission, would never have put us onto emission. We were again blinkered by our previous experience of looking for its But OH was only seen as an absorption. We were not expecting, though we looked for emission in many places in those days, we hadn't expected narrowband emission.
It's always easy to see these things at hindsight.
And, you know, our filters have been 25 kHz instead of 37, and it would have gone the other side of the baseline, and then we would have been onto it. But it's just curious that the zero, that the filter just happened to go down to zero.
While we're talking about such things, can we go back to your extragalactic hydrogen days? And you know what I'm going to say now about the Robertson and Keeler, is it pronounced, or Keeler?
Keeler
result. I mean, what is your side of this?
Oh, well, that's a very subtle one. Though Ron Allen has repeated this, and I'll say, under my very strong urging, I went to Norsey after we'd done it and talked to Blum and said somebody had to repeat it because it was an important result, and we'd repeated it and kept getting the same result. Somebody had to do it with a different system, and that Norsey had just been completed and was the obvious system.
Well, you did it several independent times, except it was the same system.
It was always the same receiver, the same telescope. And as it turned out, it's exactly the same setting of the focus. Now, Ron has explained it away in terms of a sinusoidal baseline ripple. But if you look at our published profile, it's not sinusoidal. It's a narrow band absorption, a few hundred kilohertz wide, an absorption of a couple of percent. Now, what we'd done was we knew that we were fighting instrumental effects. So we decided to compare. The whole experiment was based on comparing a source where we were expecting absorption with another source where you wouldn't expect absorption, which had almost the same antenna temperature. And the basic equations you could write out all involve antenna temperature. And so by matching the antenna temperatures very closely, you could cancel out most of the effects.
What was your rationale for a source that would have an absorption and another one that would not?
Well, for example, in the case of Virgo A, it's a fairly strong source. It turned out that the nearest source in antenna temperature to Virgo A, the Parkes dish, turned out to be the Moon. And there was obviously not going to be any high velocity 21 centimeter absorption between us and the Moon.
Okay, using the Moon array.
So we always observed when the Moon was close to Virgo, and just went from Virgo to the Moon and back to Virgo. And even on the raw data, there was obviously an absorption in Virgo that wasn't present on the Moon. You could see the absorption just showing up on the raw data before it was integrated with 2 sigma sensitivity, but it was there, obviously. So we were getting an effect that it was clearly present in Virgo and not in the Moon. And we were confident that we got real instrumental effects. What it turned out to be is that the Parkes antenna at long wavelengths, at decimeter wavelengths, because of the large focus cabin, there are many, many reflections take place between the bottom of the focus cabin and the surface apex of the dish. And you get a Fabry-Perot fringe set up there.
This is no different from the recent problems on the 140 foot with recombination lines, or on the Bond dish now. Or is it?
Well, no, it's more specific, because the 140 foot effects are pretty well sinusoidal.
Yeah.
And the Bond dish effects are almost sort of quasi random. but it's a baseline effect. But what happened is that it turns out that because of the high reflection coefficient between these two surfaces, we had a Fabry-Perot echelon. And this produces not a sinusoidal modulation of baseline, but a real Fabry-Perot fringes, which have a width of a few hundred kilohertz and a depth of about 2%.
And a spacing of how much?
and a spacing of 5.7 megahertz. And we hadn't covered, and I had not covered, we must have covered about 4 megahertz. But we hadn't gone far enough to see the next one.
We're going plus or minus 2, so you're going about halfway to the next
one. Yep. Yes, we've gone about halfway to the next one. And the baseline was nice and flat, because it was a real, real favorite Perot. I mean, it was really... It's really, really like that.
You'd like to claim this as the first application of Fermi Perot in radio astronomy? Yeah.
And it was just unfortunate that the with the focus setting, with the focal length of parts and the frequency that we were using, that at 21 centimeters, the apparent velocity of that dip was plus 1200 kilometers a second. So we had a narrow band absorption.
And the width was reasonable.
The width was reasonable of a few hundred kilohertz. The width was reasonable. It wasn't a very broad thing. The depth was reasonable, it was only a cent or something. And the velocity was spot on, plus 1200 kilometers a second. Now, as it's turned out, I'm very interested in these baseline effects and antennas, and my work on molecules has shown a lot more of this. This fringe is washed out if you look at an extended source, this Faber Perot fringe. It's present on a point source, but if you go to an extended source, it smears out, it gets washed out. The rays from an extended source, like the moon, are coming in over a variety of angles, and you don't get the nice phase cancellation.
But
so essentially, this is a modulation on the aperture efficiency, but you don't get a comparable modulation on the beam.
The beam efficiency. Yes, yes.
That is this modulation is spread out.
Basically, you can't get the standing wave if it's not coming
directly in from a unique direction. You don't get the good.
It might reflect once. Might go up once, but you not back and forth.
To get a sharp Faber Perot fringe, you need an N reflection, where N is 4 or 5. So at least 3.
So your comparison source was not quite enough in similar properties, really. That's another way to look at
Well,
it.
Well, you see, we were also looking at, in the time we were doing Virgo A versus the Moon, we were doing Fornax A versus some other point source, and we did quite a number of other sources, and this thing didn't show up on any of the other sources, because in every other case we had compared two point sources and we got total cancellation.
Yeah.
So it only showed up on Virgo A versus the Moon.
Right.
And you could show it wasn't in the raw data from the Moon. It was in the raw data from
the antenna.
So that was
that's unfortunate. Has this explanation ever been written down or published anywhere? I don't think so.
No, I've never found the appropriate place.
The Journal of Negative Results and Retractions.
The Journal of Retractions, yes. Yes, I didn't know of an appropriate place.
Well, there isn't. That is a problem, I think, in science. These things hang around, and then especially someone that's not in a field, you find them, specialization, you find them quoting things that people in the field have long since discounted.
Yes. So I really have to do this somewhere, but I've got to find an appropriate journal to.
Yeah, I don't know where it is though.
If I just sort of just troll to send it off to Astronomy and Astrophysics, and then what Potash would do with it.
A research note under instrumentation or something.
Yeah. The it was an instrumental effect, but it was a much more subtle instrumental effect than Ron Allen wrote. I actually refereed Ron Allen's paper for Astronomy and Astrophysics and was critical of it because I actually sent Ron a copy of this, but he didn't modify his paper. But it wasn't such a... I'd been long enough in the field not to make elementary errors.
Yeah.
We might now regard this as an elementary error. But all my work since in hunting for for exotic molecules at parks has shown that the baseline effects you get depend not only on the source intensity but also on the source size.
And on the characteristics of the particular antenna.
Yes, but with a given antenna.
Yeah, even with a given antenna, yeah.
Our problems of subtracting baselines on Sagittarius B2 is to find another source that is the same strength as Sagittarius B2 and has about the same same sort of distribution over the, including the near and sideways.
What about the other extragalactic hydrogen work that you did during that time? Could you briefly summarize that?
Well, this was fairly straightforward work to determine rotation curves for a number of southern galaxies. And we did about half a dozen.
But the only other people working in this was the Harvard group, is that not true?
Eugene Epstein was was working at Harvard at the time, and Mort Roberts was coming into the field.
Right, he was just coming in on a rail.
And there was a little bit of work going on. Well, Heidman was doing some work at Twinalo.
Heidman was at working at Twinalo at that
time? He was at Medon, but visited Twinalo for observations. He did M51 here. Boulders and Hogbone had done a few sorts.
That's right, there were a few other ones. And then also there was at Twinalo, there was some Dutch work to.
M31 of course, and then a few. M31 had been done.
Van Woerden et al.
M33.
But it wasn't that neglected.
Actually, at that time, we had as many galaxies in the southern skies as we had in the north. It was before Mort Roberts really got going on the 340 Green Lake.
It's really after the big ones got done that the field became neglected, and Mort Roberts sort of had it all to himself for several years.
It was hard work. Low sensitivity, a lot of observing time, big fields to work on. I would have kept in the field, except that we got on to OH and the Galactic Center region.
Yeah.
That was obviously more productive in terms of observing time on the telescope. And I've been distracted in the molecules since then. In the OH we got into water vapor, and you know the history of that.
Well,
very thoroughly.
My history is going to sort of stop about mid-60s. I think it becomes sort of just too much.
When you get to pulsars.
My generation, something very interesting like pulsars, if I can get a good story on it like I had from John Baldwin, maybe I'll stick it in.
I think this pulsar story is pretty well recorded.
Is it? Where?
Well, one example. There have been quite a few review papers on pulsars by many various people.
No, I mean the few weeks at the Cavendish.
Yes, well, I think Fleming Hewish has written that.
Has he? Where?
Scientific American?
Perhaps so.
There's a Hewish article in Scientific American on pulsars that gives a fair bit of history. And you can get the rest from people who are still at Cambridge.
Well, thank you very much.
Interstellar molecules is another area which was also blown up, but you were in the States at the time.
Yeah, I know about the beginning of that, and I think I might include that. I haven't really decided exactly where to end. That is the interview with Brian Robinson on 20 July 1973 at Twinalo. End of tape also.